This is Michelle Schabowski with the Physician Assistant History Society, and I am interviewing Dr. Tonya Petit. It is June 23rd, 2017. I'm at the PA History Society office, and where are you today, ma'am?
I'm in Oakland, California.
This is for future transcribers. Could you please say your name, spell it, and any initials after your name, like PhD, PAC, stuff like that?
Okay. My name is Tonya Petit, T-O-N-I-A, P as in Paul, O-T-E-A-T. The initials after my name are PhD, P-A-C, M-P-H.
All right, great. So let's start the interview. So could you tell us a bit about your background, like where your hometown was, what college you attended?
Yes. I grew up in a small town in North Carolina called Graham. I went to college at Yale in New Haven and moved to Atlanta after I graduated, and that's where I ended up going to PA school at Emory, and I did National Health Service Corps after PA school because that helped to pay for my education, and that sent me to New York, where I worked for several years and then traveled in different places in the country working as a PA, and got involved in international health work and went back to get a master's in public health at Emory and then to a PhD in public health.
What influenced you to join the medical field?
I had always been interested from I was a little girl in how things work, especially how human bodies work. Like, they seem very complicated and complex, but all seem to work as individual systems and interacting with each other. And I always wanted to learn more about that. And I also come from a mother who's a helping professional, and I think I inherited some of that desire to help. And so bringing in the science and also the helping aspect of medical care into one place, it just made sense to be a part of that field.
And why did you specifically decide to become a PA?
I'd actually never heard of a PA before. When I was in college, I was initially pre-med, and then I found that I didn't really like the sort of cutthroat nature of that atmosphere. And then I worked as a lay health worker in a women's health center in Atlanta, and I met a PA, and I had never heard of a PA, and she told me about what she did, and it sounded really interesting, and I started to explore, you know, what that would look like, and I was very excited that it was a two-year program instead of, it seemed like 1,000 years to go the medical route, and I also felt like, right? And then I felt like, if I didn't like it, then I'd invested, 7 years of my life, and then I'd be like, well, never mind, I'm going to be a barista at Starbucks. So, it seemed like the right amount of investment and also would allow me to provide patient care pretty quickly.
Okay. So. Were there any challenges to becoming a PA, or was it a pretty easy, straightforward thing to do?
It was pretty straightforward. I was living in Atlanta. I applied to Emory. I got in, and I went. I think the biggest challenge is for everyone getting an education is how to pay for it, and
yes.
So I felt very lucky. Yeah, very, very lucky to get the National Health Service Corps scholarship.
What is that? What is the National Health Service Corps?
It's a federally...
Okay.
Yeah, National Health Service Corps. It's a federally funded program that provides either loan repayment or scholarship funds for health professionals who agree to give a certain amount of time back to underserved communities.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, once I graduated, they paid for my education in advance, and then I owed them the same number of years that they'd paid for.
Oh, that's nice.
It was perfect, because then they also help you get a job.
Right. So do you travel? Like, do they assign you places to go when you go, or can you pick?
They send a list of approved sites, and then you interview with those sites, and they have to hire you.
Okay.
You know, they... you know, it makes the job search somewhat easier because I'm going to hopefully get a job at one of these places on the list.
Right. And that's when you moved to New York? Did they send you there?
Yeah.
Okay. So what kind of work did you do for them? Like,
I was at a methadone maintenance program.
Okay.
Yeah, which is a really big change from being in a small town in North Carolina and even being in Atlanta.
Right. I bet it was a culture shock.
Yeah. It was a bit of a culture shock, but it was an experience I wouldn't change for the world. I learned so much more than I ever would have probably figured out how to learn on my own.
What did you do after that?
After I completed my service at the National Health Service Corps, then I stayed in New York for a few more years working at a community health center.
Mm-hmm.
And then I moved to Kansas City for a few years and worked at a family practice. Mm-hmm. And then I moved back to Atlanta, and I worked in HIV there at the Grady Hospital for many years. Yeah.
Well, tell me about the HIV clinic, because that seems like you've kind of dedicated your professional career to it, mm-hmm. like with HIV and underserved communities. So what started that?
Well, I guess I told an incomplete story about why I was so interested in becoming a PA. I've always been interested in medical care and in the medical field. Mm-hmm. But in particular, as I learned more about the HIV crisis while I was in college, I was a volunteer at the AIDS service organization there, and I really wanted to be able to do more. Mm-hmm. And at the time, people were really frightened of people living with HIV, really like afraid to touch them, didn't want them around. I don't know if you know the story of Ryan White, the little boy that was kicked out of school because he had HIV, and mm-hmm. they went, and I felt like that wasn't...
Okay. Was this during the 80s? Like what, around?
Yeah, this was during the...
Okay.
Yeah, this was during the 80s.
Okay, yeah, I remember.
Yes, I graduated from college in 87, so it was the 80s that people were sort of learning more.
Right.
And I really thought that was unfair.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to be, you know, if people needed health care, mm-hmm. I was not afraid. I wanted to be somebody who felt that need. So I went to school to learn how to be a healthcare provider so I could provide care for people with HIV.
You worked in an HIV clinic in Atlanta, and how long were you there for?
I was there for 7 or 8 years.
Okay. What did you do after that? Are you still there?
No.
Okay.
If I could have taken it with me, I would have. I really loved it. It was, you know, when you have that feeling, I'm doing what I'm supposed to do and the place I'm supposed to do it feeling.
Yeah.
That's how I felt working there.
Oh.
Yeah. But I was doing a very strange job of working for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in International HIV.
Okay.
And also working at a clinic.
Oh, okay.
One of my colleagues was very funny. He said, so what, you're in clinic on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and then you're like in another country on Tuesday and Thursday? I was like, well, not exactly. but they were very flexible and let me do that work. But as I continued to do more international work, I realized that I needed more training in public health. And I wanted to do research because I felt like I had lots of questions that I didn't know the answer to, and that not every that I would either wait for other people to do the research to answer those questions, or that's something that I could take the lead on doing. So that's how I ended up moving to Baltimore to go to Hopkins to get my PhD in international health.
Okay.
At the School of Public Health there.
With the international program, so you actually did go overseas to work with people.
I did.
Oh, wow.
So I did.
What kind of places did you go to?
For the first couple of years, the majority of places that I went were in sub-Saharan Africa. So it was basically supporting people around monitoring and evaluation of their clinical programs. So many of the places were not used to providing longitudinal care. They were basically, you know, my kid's sick, I'm going to bring my kid in, and, you know, like a minute clinic kind of place.
Mm-hmm.
And so with HIV care, you need to be able to provide chronic ongoing care and monitor medical records so that you can track people's progress.
Mm-hmm.
And so setting up those systems were often things that people needed help with. And then for the people who were sort of over health systems more broadly, they needed to be able to track a series of health centers.
So you went to Johns Hopkins and
mm-hmm.
got your PhD, and mm-hmm. then you went into education, or did you go back to clinical practice?
Well, I never left clinical practice, actually. I just think it helps to ground me to see individual patients. I really like that interaction. So I continued to see patients while I was in the doctoral program. I worked at a community health center that saw a lot of people with HIV. And then after I graduated, I actually did leave clinical practice for 2 years and went to work for the Office of the Global AIDS Coordinator in D.C. So they're the people who administer the U.S. government's international HIV program called PEPFAR. And I did that for 2 years. My job is a key populations advisor. So I would travel to countries that were doing HIV programs, helping them to set up or improve their HIV programs for men who have sex with men, sex workers, and people who inject drugs. And so I did that for 2 years before I came back and became an academic.
What university did you start teaching at?
I'm back at Hopkins.
So what courses do you teach at Johns Hopkins?
The most consistent course I teach is one that I developed. That's the epidemiology. Yeah, I was very excited about it. It's the epidemiology of LGBT health, and I've been teaching it since before I taught it. Funny enough, I taught it before I left as a student. I developed it as part of a class I was taking on curriculum development, mm-hmm. and then I taught it for undergrads over the summer, and then it became a regular course at the School of Public Health that I co-taught before I joined the faculty full-time, and then I've been teaching it since.
Are there any other areas of advocacy that you take part in?
Yes, I'm very much an advocate for LGBT health, in particular the role of stigma and discrimination in driving health disparities for our LGBT population, particularly transgender populations, both domestically and globally, but more of that work is in the United States.
So why focus on the transgender population? Are they more at risk?
Yes, we see significant health disparities in almost every arena that you look in. There's enormous health disparities related to HIV, particularly for transgender women. When I was a student, I didn't get published until after I graduated because that's the land of publication, but we did a systematic review looking at all the research that had been done on HIV among transgender women, and the HIV prevalence was incredibly high. It was almost 20%, mm-hmm. so one out of every five. And, you know, in the U.S. in general, the HIV prevalence is less than 1%. That's about 0.3%. So having a 19% HIV prevalence is incredibly high and very disturbing. And I think at the time, very few programs existed for HIV awareness, education, prevention services, care and treatment services for transgender people.
What form does this advocacy take? Like, do you do information projects? Like to, words are failing me.
I'm glad I'm not the only one that has this. The words are just not there.
Right. Like information campaigns, like to get it out there, or like clinics and areas where this is more prevalent. Like how does this take shape? Let's put it that way.
Yeah, in a couple of ways. I feel like in my clinical hat ways, I do a lot of provider education because I know I didn't get any training in transgender health. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of transgender people, based on the research that we know, having access to a welcoming provider and somebody who knows how to provide gender-affirming care makes a huge difference in how much people are willing to engage in care. Mm-hmm. So helping providers get there is a lot of the advocacy work that I do, training providers and explaining the consequences of not providing gender-affirming care, as well as how do you do it.
Okay.
So that's a lot of what I do.
Reaching out to providers, how does that take place? Is it usually like they contact you or you contact them? Like how do you spread this message?
That's great. Yeah, so it's a combination. Often at this point people will contact me because there's more visibility around transgender people and people realize what they don't know and they are asking for that information. But there's also the advocacy of like, hey, I'm going to, you know, for the PA conference, I want to make sure that there's a session or more than one session on transgender health, or when I'm educating students to infuse case studies around transgender people in that education, or if I'm doing a presentation about HIV or anything else, that I make sure that transgender people are visible in those presentations so that people don't, I mean, it's sort of a both and, so you want to provide that in-depth education for people who want and need to know more, but also for people who don't think that they need to know more or don't know that they need to know more, making sure that transgender people are visible in all the other kinds of clinical education, I think is really important too.
What else are you involved in? You say you do a lot with the LGBT education and clinic work as a whole, just making sure that people have sessions they can attend to, making sure these things are mentioned and present.
Yes, I'm also on the board, I'm Vice President of Education on the board of GLAMA, Health Professionals Advocating, this is terrible, I'm not remembering, Health Professionals Advancing LGBT Equality. So we sponsor a conference every year on LGBT health that's both clinically focused and research focused. Mm-hmm. So we provide workshops, plenary sessions, and things like that for people to learn more broadly around LGBT health. I'm an associate editor of LGBT Health, which is a scientific journal that publishes research on LGBT health. I could just keep going. I'm on an LGBT working group at Hopkins where we try to make sure that the public health students have access to education around LGBT health as well. And, of course, that's where my research is.
Right. Yes, of course. So is there anything else, like career-wise, that you want to mention, like any milestones or accomplishments you're very proud of?
That is a great question. I hadn't really thought, you know, you just sort of plug along in your day and you don't think a lot about it. Well, I do. I was like, oh, wait, there should... I mean, I think getting a PhD was like a huge deal.
Yeah, that is enormous.
Yeah, well, I was the first person in my immediate family to go to college.
Okay.
And so I didn't anticipate going to get a doctorate. I was pretty excited to have a master's degree when that happened in PA school. So yeah, I mean, it was tougher than I thought because I was an older student. I'd been in clinical practice for 10 years as a PA. So it's about a decade older than most of the other students on the PhD program. And the whole pull all-nighter thing doesn't work after a certain age.
Yes. What has been one of your greatest accomplishments in your PA career? Something that you think of and it just has that warm glow around your heart, besides getting your... How about after your PhD?
After my PhD?
Yeah, post-PhD. Huh.
Well, I think the most moving moment that I had as a PA... Mm-hmm. was when I had a patient tell me, this is when I was working at Grady in Atlanta, mm-hmm. to tell me, you know, I know that you don't know everything, but I know that you care enough about me as your patient that you will find out whatever you need to know to take the best care of me. And I still cry when I think about that.
Oh, that is
that
a good one.
Meant so much to me. Well, because I think there's all this pressure to pretend as a healthcare professional that you know everything.
Right.
And I'm terrible at pretending.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't. I just say, you know, I don't know. I'm going to try to find out. And that she trusted me and my care for her as my patient to know that I would get the best information possible and take the best care of her possible. And that was more important to her mm-hmm. than anything else.
Right.
So that felt like if I can keep inspiring that feeling in patients, mm-hmm. then I feel like I'm absolutely doing my job.
I take it you're very happy having chosen a physician assistant as a profession. No regrets?
No, I mean, I'm not a person who regrets. I feel like everything is a learning experience, and I think being a PA has provided me the flexibility to do all sorts of different things that I wouldn't have been able to do had I chosen a different path.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Good. If a PA wanted to volunteer for something, like they wanted mm-hmm. to give back in some way, what areas do you think are most in need of that? And do you have recommendations of groups and organizations these people can contact if they wanted mm-hmm. to help?
I have a couple of different answers. I think if people want to do clinical work specifically with LGBT people mm-hmm. and they live in a city that has like an LGBT-focused community health center or clinic or something like that, reaching out to them and offering to volunteer would probably be very welcome.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's also, if there are organizations, youth-focused organizations mm-hmm. and older organizations, I think that there's this sort of demographic visibility to being somewhere between the ages of 25 and 55, and then if you're older than that or younger than that, then somehow you disappear.
Right.
But there are LGBT people who are very young and maybe struggling with acceptance, both self-acceptance or from their family. And then there's older people who, you know, probably came out in a time where it was even more dangerous and stigmatized than now and are now older and are facing going maybe into a nursing home or some sort of group setting. And mm-hmm. what do they do about their identity and will they feel safe and need support and resources as well. So I think those are two places of great need. There's an organization called SAGE that is a national organization that focuses on LGBT elders that people could Google and find out where the closest chapter might be to them and offer volunteer.
So do you have any advice for future generations of PAs?
I think only just don't limit yourself. When I went to PA school, there was only like a couple that had master's programs, and most were bachelor's trained, and people were saying there's free jobs for PAs, and you can either get a job in a city where you want or doing something you want. And I think that you can build relationships and help people learn more about what PAs are able to do and, you know, create a path for yourself.
And thank you very much. This has been a great interview. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us.